This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org.
All right, so welcome, Dr. Lyle. How are you doing this evening?
Good. Good to be back.
Excellent. So a couple episodes ago, we started the show talking about how to deal with flaky friends, how to deal with flaky people in general. And we were reading the Cosmopolitan magazine, the peer-reviewed journal Cosmopolitan, about how to deal with or why your friend is flaky. And the author was a self-admitted flake. And she was listing 10 reasons, at least they were good reasons to her, about why she flakes. A couple of them were that she's trying to please everybody, and so she's ending up overextending herself. She's not really flaky when it matters, things like that. And we took a call, and we got some more information about the caller on a slightly different topic. So here we are today. And we're going to finish the part about how to deal with flakes. And so... What was interesting to me about that show was that you said when the comment that the author made, which is I'm not flaky when it really matters, is you said, well, what does that mean, right? It always matters.
Right.
It might not matter to the flake, but it matters all the time.
Yeah.
And that nobody's ever not looking. Looking forward to hear a little bit more from you about flaky people and flakes and how to deal with flakes. Did I say flakes enough? Is that...
Yeah, that's good. That's good. I like it. All right. Let's talk about a couple different things. And that is that I have two different types of problems that will come to me in therapy. One will be when parents are frustrated with their young children. So their young children, when young children might be 9 years old or 10 years old or 12 years old, et cetera, sort of that sort of age. And the kids are flaky, their room's a mess, they're not turning their homework on time, this sort of thing.
Did you talk to my dad? Is that how you knew this?
Yeah, you got it. So
ongoing problem.
So this is a way that I encourage parents to deal with this. What parents usually do is they usually turn up the anger. So they're trying to sort of intimidate the kids into saying, look, you know, this is really serious to us and by God, et cetera. And there's that generally doesn't work very well. It might work, but sometimes if you get obviously a nice kid and you push them a little bit, that's not a problem. The problem is when you get kids that are naturally stubborn. So you'll get some kids that are naturally stubborn that are going to dig in their heels, and they're going to be difficult to deal with. So I had a friend of mine that said he was real stubborn, and there's no way he was going to clean his room, and his parents would yell at him, and he would yell back. You actually know this guy. This is Larry. And so he's a mutual friend of ours. So anyway, the point is that there are kids like this, and the parents can be very frustrated, and they're the dads yell but don't care that much, and the mom is really frustrated because the kid won't do these basic things. So instead of yelling, what we want to do is we want to box them in, and the way we box them in is through a technique that I'm sure other people have invented it, but I invented it independently. I call it gloat therapy. So what we do is we make for ourselves, jot down a little list of the things that you do for them that you don't want to do. Okay, so it might be drive their friends to the movies and then have to come pick them up, or it might be, you know, packing their lunch, or it might be, you know, it could be something as silly as their $3 allowance, doing their laundry, anything like that. Okay, so and so this is it's key that we have something that we do for them that we would just as soon not do. And, you know, trust me, a 10-year-old is perfectly capable of doing their own laundry. So if you're doing your kid's laundry and your kid's a slob, there is no reason for you to have to be doing this. So what we do is we sit the kid down and we say, okay, you know what? Here's the deal. That what we're going to do is we're going to have the following arrangement. And the arrangement is that on Saturday morning at 10 a.m., I am going to inspect your room. And your room needs to be in perfect order. Okay? It has to be, the bed has to be perfectly made with no wrinkles in it. It has to be that all your clothes are in the drawers and everything's going to have to be in perfect order and there can't be any junk under the bed. And your desk has to be cleared off and orderly and any little papers in the proper stacks. In other words, this has to be outstanding. And that's fine if it isn't. So let me give you another example. If you live in a reasonable neighborhood and the school is, you know, a mile and a half away, so it would be, you know, all of 20 minutes walk for the kid or half an hour walk for the kid to have to go to school, and it's perfectly safe and other kids walk along that pathway. If all that is true but you drive your kid to school, then this is would be another potential avenue. So that would be something to hold over their head. So you hold over their head and you say, you know, here's the deal. I pretty much don't like doing your laundry. I want, you know, so I just soon not do your laundry. It'd be a big relief for me not to have to do your laundry. So what's going to happen is on Saturday morning, I'm going to give you an inspection at exactly 10 o'clock. And if your room fails inspection, then you are going to do your own laundry, you know, for the next 2 weeks. Okay, that's it. That's the deal. See you later. And we don't say another word about it. Not one word. Even if the kid mentions it and jokingly tries to test us, we don't say anything. Just smile. No problem. And at Saturday morning at 10 o'clock, you walk up to that room and you open the door. Now, that kid will know it's coming. And it's in all probability, that kid's room, that kid will be like starting to work on the room. They won't actually have done very much. They'll actually have started like, oh, yeah, I'm going to get to it. And we walk in and we see that it's not done. And what we do is we raise our hand above our heads and go, yes. Yes. Okay. This room fails inspection. That's great. I don't have to do your laundry. Fabulous. I'm going to go sit and relax and have myself a cup of really cool tea and relax because I don't have to do your laundry for the next 2 weeks. Okay. And it's interesting because the kids will be like, no, no. You know, they'll start to negotiate. And you're like, no, that was the deal. Fantastic. See you later. Okay. Walk off. Now, the problem is you won and it really pisses them off and they're all upset. And then they want to, you know, it depends upon the kid, they want to renegotiate. And if you got a really cool customer that says, well, I don't care, no problem. You go down your list of other things that you do for them and you up the ante. So now little Mr. I don't care is going to have to walk himself to school. And quite frankly, if he's 2 miles from school, if it's a boy in particular and it's not like the neighborhood's fine, there's no reason in the world, if you're not living in Kansas in the winter, that they can't ride their bicycle. I rode my bicycle a long ways to school. And people are saying, oh, it's much more dangerous today. It is less dangerous today than it was when I went to school. Okay, so the world is considerably less dangerous than it was in 1970.
Yeah, so when you went to school, you had to go uphill both ways.
I had to hike for miles in the snow with Indian moccasins that we traded from the trading post. Okay. So anyway, point is that we gloat. And then you know, then we have for a couple, 3 days, we say, well, next Saturday you'll have another chance, and you're out of business for the next 2 weeks on that. But next Saturday, the deal is going to be this other thing, okay, that I want done. So all your homework's going to have to be on time, or I'm not going to do what? Take you and your friend to the movies. Oh, no, you said you were going to. No, no, this is the deal. It's reasonable. This is reasonable. I'm not asking you to get A's, and I'm not asking you to do it perfect. I'm asking you to have it turned in every day of the week, and if it's not, no problem. I want to all come in here and inspect your homework before you go to bed each night, and if it's not all laid out there and done, no problem. Okay? So this is how we gloat. We set these things up, and then when they don't do them, we don't yell. We laugh and smile and act like we won. Now, what will happen is the next Saturday at inspection, whatever, you know, if we set that up the next Saturday, for example, for the following 2 weeks of laundry or however we're going to do it, then when we go in there, and at that point, it's very likely that it will be in perfect condition. Now, it might be at 80% perfect condition, and they're still working on it, at which point we do the same thing, hands over our heads and like, wow, fantastic, you fail again, okay? And then they're like, no, and then they're going to go complain to Dad, Dad, I was really, you know, et cetera. It's like, no, it wasn't done, and you got to have both partners in on this so it's all cool. Like, no, the rules were the rules, that's it, you lose, okay? And if the kid wins, then what you say is, oh, man. So you're like, God, you're upset. So this is how we reverse the entire thing on them to where it is that they do exactly what we want them to do perfectly, and we act like we're upset about it, and they're happy about it. This is how we get kids to do things, okay? Now, when they get older, the next set of techniques I'm going to talk about is how we deal with people. You've got, you know, a 20-year-old that's sort of dropping out of college and being a flake and doesn't want to get a job, and Dad's getting mad at him and snarling, and when are you going to make something yourself, or what are you going to do? This kind of a problem. So when we have young adults that aren't getting off their rear ends and accomplishing anything, then what we're going to do is we're going to turn up the heat on them in a different way. So these are, you know, people's circumstances are slightly different, but these are some general principles. What we do is that we are going to we're going to essentially try to set up the following, it's basically a libertarian kind of a situation, which is that we have a principle of maximum freedom and maximum self-responsibility until proven otherwise. So they get tremendous latitude. We're not going to yell at them and check at them until it turns out that they have screwed up. But we're going to have certain conditions where we're going to have essentially no resources going from us to them. There's a few exceptions. The exceptions are if they have a car, we won't give them a nickel for gasoline, but we will absolutely make sure the car's insured, okay, because that would be a potential disaster. We also are not going to let their teeth rot out of their head, so we're going to make sure that dentistry is done when it's indicated. And the third thing is we're going to make sure, obviously, that they have health insurance. So those are the three exceptions to the general rule that they don't get any resources. So let's talk about other supposedly necessary resources that these young people need to have. Answer,
iPhones.
Rent. Yeah, I was going to say rent, food, and cell phones. And they don't need rent, they don't need food, and they don't need cell phones. They don't need anything. They can be homeless, and that's perfectly fine. If you're going to make it okay for them to come home and live with you, then there should be very, very strict, draconian expectations. And the expectations are going to be things like the bathroom is going to be spick and span every day. Your room is going to be spick and span every day. You're going to owe us $500 a month for rent. In other words, you're going to charge them market rent, although they may not have to pay a deposit and the first month's rent in advance. They're going to owe it to you, okay? And we're going to set a short-term move-out date that's going to be 60 or 90 days. It's going to be, and there's going to be a curfew, and there's going to be a peep out of that room after 10 o'clock. So the bottom line is they're going to have their own shelf in the refrigerator, and they're not going to eat your food. So essentially, we are going to make this as if they are a roommate in a very strict, very reasonable, responsibly run boarding house. And it can be all friendly because it's your mom and your dad, and we can talk over problems and help them figure out how they're going to get a job. But the bottom line is that they still owe, and this is the rules, and they have to absolutely toe the line perfectly. And they don't need a cell phone. They don't need anything. You say, well, how are they going to get a job? No problem. They can call from the family phone, and they can use the family phone if you've got a landline. They can use email, etc. They can hustle together a Go phone for themselves, and that's what they can use on their job applications. This is not your problem. Okay, they can figure this out. Now, the way we spring this on them is as follows: we say, you know, we've been noticing that you're growing up, and we figured that we really hadn't sort of really realized that. So we see why it is that, you know, we've nagged you about doing this and doing that, and you kind of haven't done things. But the truth is that you're big enough now. It's hard for parents to realize that sometimes kids are big enough and smart enough to more or less run their own show. So it's an easy mistake for parents to make. And so it's time we recognize that you're much more capable of making up your own mind and being independent in your decisions. So from now on, we're going to treat you like an adult instead of like a kid. Now, in the adult world, there's rules, and you have to follow consequences, and that's just how it is. Like, if you don't show up on time for stuff, you lose your job, or if you do things wrong, you go to jail, et cetera. So, you know, we're going to have simple rules, too, and we're not going to yell at you because, you know, you yell at children. You don't yell at adults. And so here's the rent. This is when it's going to be due. We want the trash taken out on every trash can in the house every day, okay, or every other day, whatever's reasonable. We want all the bathrooms scrubbed, whatever it is that you want to do. Certainly their bathroom needs to be spick and span. And if they're students and they're a flake, you have minimal grade performance. And if they're in school and obviously they're getting financial support and they are getting a cell phone and things like that, then we have minimal grade performance that is acceptable, that would be very achievable by them. And if they don't perform, then they lose all these consequences. Okay? they can lose their car, no problem, lose their cell phone, and they can ride their bike to the library. This is not a problem. So the notion is that parents have a lot of anxiety about pulling the trigger on these things. There's many reasons why. There's several layers of reasoning that will stop parents from this. When I describe these types of things, parents get like an exhilarated, giddy, like, and then they feel like, oh, no, they really can't do that, you know. And it's like, in my attitude, why wouldn't we? Your child has been a complete flake for the last 3.5 years. Everybody's irritated with them. They've got 2 little part-time jobs that they then flaked out on, and now they're thinking about going back to school, and they're 23.5 years old, and nothing's happening, okay? So the answer is that these individuals are lazy and irresponsible, and in the wild, they would not be able to be, and they wouldn't be. So parents know that their kid is a pretty decent kid. They're just acting in a lazy and irresponsible fashion. And the truth is that they would not be lazy and irresponsible if they were in a Stone Age village. In a Stone Age village, if you're lazy and irresponsible, there's natural consequences like poverty and hunger. Mm-hmm. And poverty and hunger actually cause 2 things, which are effort and responsibility. And so what we need to do as parents when we have a kid that has a flaky chip in their head, and a lot of them do, is we need to essentially impose something that begins to look like the Stone Age environment on the child. And taking away their cell phone hardly throws them back to the Stone Age, for God's sakes. But what we do is we start to put the pressure on. And when we kick them out of the house after their little 60-day hiatus, we need to know that we mean business, that you are going to be leaving this house in 60 days. So you got the next 60 days to hustle together, find some job, and save some money, so you're ultimately going to need to pay us back, but you don't have to pay us back the whole $1,000 you're going to owe us. You could pay us back $100 a month, you know, for the next year, but in the next 2 months, you need to be saving up a deposit for the next place you're going to live in. So you better get busy. okay?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, you know, sits around, plays the guitar, etc. Okay, so 2 months goes by, and let me tell you what you do. You kick him out. You do not let him have another month. It's not appropriate. You kick them out, and they're like, well, where am I going to go? It's like, I don't know. Not, you know, hey, good luck. Hope you got some good friends. Okay. And the point is, it's like the deer in the headlights is you have to understand that they need the fear of God in them sometimes. And they will figure it out. And it's actually really good for them to figure it out. So they will lean on their friend. They'll couch surf for a while. God knows what it is that they're going to do. And they're going to cry and whine. And this is where you have to get the mother to not cave. Okay? Nope. You're going to go. You're going to go out there and just figure it out. And they don't need to starve. You make sure they know where the homeless shelter is. And you make sure they know where the free food is. There's free food at every community. And that's it. See you later. Hey, go for it. Real pleasant. No yelling, et cetera. You need to make a peace as a parent with some negative consequences and understand that there's things that we can afford and things we cannot afford. So there's some things that we can't afford. You have to make peace with several things that are the worst-case scenario. Here are some worst-case scenario things that parents need to make peace with in order to cure the flakiness of young adults. You must make peace with bad grades in school. You have to be willing to say, hey, if you're, you know, if this is what's happening, if you go below these certain grades, that's fine. Don't yell at them and scream at them and grab them by the neck. Go ahead and let them mess it up. That's okay. We can live with that. There's always ways to mitigate that later after they've awoken at age 28 with a sense of responsibility. You can always go back and renegotiate screwed up grades, et cetera. You just let them give them maximum self-responsibility. Do not, you know, basically hover around them like a helicopter mother on top of a 22-year-old that's at the JC that's perfectly capable of getting good grades, decent grades, but isn't because they're a flake. Don't hover all over them. It's not your job. Let them screw it up. It's totally fine. Another thing that it's fine for them to screw up is for them to get a credit card and then live for a while on that, $2,000 or $3,000 with credit, and then screw it up and wreck their credit. This is totally fine. Okay. This is, again, youth has to pay the price. They got to find out how this all works. And if it gives them some bumpier roads for a couple of years, this is not a problem. You don't wake them up in the morning to get them to make sure that they get to their job on time. Forget it. They can get on their bicycle because they no longer have their car, and they can ride, you know, they can ride all across town to get to that job. Not a problem. They can take the bus. In other words, what we need is we need them to be inconvenienced. Now, another thing is the homelessness. Are you still there?
Mm-hmm. Nope. Yep.
Okay. So you have to be willing to have these kids be homeless. They'll figure it out. They'll sleep in their friend's backyard, in their friend's garage, et cetera. They'll work it out. Now, you almost never have to get there, but you have to be willing to get there. You have to be willing to threaten them, and you have to mean business when you're going to tell them that they got a deadline. Now, there's a few things where we need to we do things slightly differently, because there's two consequences that are really tough that we never want to deal with as a parent, and we have to be gentle, but be very much parents around these two issues. Those two issues are drugs and pregnancy. So, any girl that has a pregnancy issue, we have to tell them, or you're a young man that may be involved, either one, you have to say, listen, if you get into trouble, you know, you come to me. You know, this is not going to be a problem. We will talk things out. We're not going to be angry. This is a tough situation, and we'll all put our heads together. You have to know, you know, we don't want to see that happen. That's a real, you know, that's a dicey situation, and there's a lot to consider there, et cetera. But if that happens, you know, that's what we're here. That's what parents are for. So you need to set it up in advance that the kid knows that that quote, horrible crisis where they could be so humiliated and embarrassed that a sensitive kid might jump off the Golden Gate Bridge rather than face you, they have to know that you are already mentally prepared for this and that you're not upset, okay? so that they can replay that in their mind if they get into trouble and they recognize that you are not going to fly off the handle and be a freakazoid. And now, second thing is about drugs. So we have to be worried about drugs because drugs don't play fair. Drugs can get their hook in some kid's mouth, and if he's genetically susceptible and too open to experience, they can get themselves into a world of hurt. And so as a result of that, there's certain things that we do. People say to me, well, you know, my kid smokes pot. It's okay if he stays home and smokes pot. No. No, it's not okay. Okay, so this is an addictive substance that draws people into a trap. You know, it leads to a generalized reduction of motivation. It actually, in some cases, causes permanent psychotic symptoms. This is like, you know, people listening to me are like, wow, what a tightwad, what a nutcase, et cetera. Well, no, not really. The truth is that, of course, it's reasonable that they do this on their own time, in their own life, at their own risk, et cetera. And, you know, if some parents are completely cool with it, that's their problem. But if a parent is worrying about why their kid is flake and a deadbeat and he's smoking pot and he's not getting a job, et cetera, then one place we start is by the no pot smoking. And how do we do this? If you're worried, and again, we're not using anger here. We're just using parental, reasonable firmness, just the way the world would treat them. If you're in the Army and you smoke pot and you get drug tested and you come back positive, oops, see you later. Okay, well, they'll give you one strike or whatever it is. But this is a problem. And in many jobs, if you test positive, you know, you're done. See you later. And nobody's angry. Nobody yells at you in the back room and jumps up and down and screams. They just give you a pink slip. That's it. It's like, oh, wait, sorry. I mean, I'll stop now. It's like, well, it's too late. You're a heavy equipment operator. You're driving, you know, 200,000-pound vehicles with gasoline in the back. No, sorry. You're done. Okay, you're never working here again. So in the same way, if you would like to, it is perfectly legitimate to tell your flaky teenager or young adult, when you're in this house, you don't need to be smoking any pot. So when you get a job and get your money together and go live with your friends, you know, it's a free country and you can do whatever you want. But in our house, that's not what you do. So if you live here, you're not going to do it. Okay, I won't do it. So good. You're not going to do it. So we will test you every day. Okay. There's these cheap little inexpensive drug tests. And we'll test you every day. And no problem. It'll just take a couple seconds and that's that. Oh, well, no. Well, that's too bad. That's how it's going to be. And the beauty of having drug tests, and this goes on, incidentally, between husbands and wives when one of them is addicted to a drug and then they're trying to break free of it, the utility of daily drug tests, that we do it without exception. We follow through every day. When a person is clean, they actually want to show that they are clean, and they want to have no second guessing on the part of their parents or their partner, because they're like, look, I'm clean. Okay, so there's kind of this quote, I trust you. Okay, we don't need that in the middle of the relationship. We don't need the person on the one side thinking, well, am I a bad guy for not trusting you? Okay, this is like Ronald Reagan, trust but verify.
mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is how we do this, and it actually very quickly becomes like a joke between the individuals, and they don't mind at all, and it's no big deal, and it takes a few seconds, and it's all cool, okay? And that way everybody knows that that person is not using. The person who has had a history of using is not using, and that takes pressure off of everybody. So we aren't looking at them suspiciously and wondering if they're telling us the truth, et cetera. We're not random testing, and then they're playing Russian roulette and trying to hope that, you know, we forget this weekend, et cetera. No, forget it. You just test every day, and you take all the pressure off. So these are the general strategies that I use that essentially lay ground rules. And obviously, every situation is a little different, but this is the general tone. if I have somebody who is a 30-year-old, young person who's struggling with a big-time drug addiction, has gone back and forth, in and out of rehab, and it's a mess, and they steal from their mother, and now mom doesn't know what to do, and they're on the street, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. What do we do? what we do is we make sure that the person has essentially a place to go, i.e. we know where the local homeless shelter is and we know what it takes to get in there. And we make sure that they have enough food. Okay, so we make sure that these basics are covered and we communicate with them. And we and things change whenever they ask for help and they want to go into some kind of treatment process and that they're really going to try. Now we're going to be a little bit more rewarding and gentle, but when they are not and they're just doing their own number and they're in trouble and their lives are chaotic, then it's not a problem. We just simply make sure that they are potentially physically safe if they choose to be so, and otherwise we don't yell. And what we're trying to signal to these people, we're actually trying to signal to this even in the 8-year-old with respect to their clean room, and certainly to the 30-year-old that's in trouble, and to everybody in between. We're trying to signal that we actually have confidence in your ability to manage these decisions, and we have confidence that you actually know what the right decisions are, and we are not going to yell at you and spend our time and energy putting a lot of pressure on you psychologically. We're not going to do that. What we're going to do is we're going to lay out some very reasonable consequences for alternative courses of action that you might take, and we're going to back those up. And we're going to back those up 100%, essentially with no negotiation. And the reason why is that we want you to have these parameters in your head as you're making your decisions. And so that's what we do. That's what everybody does with everybody else all the time in all business relationships in life.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we do. We essentially are putting these problems on a business-like basis, and we're taking out of it the interpersonal angst and fury and guilt-inducing, et cetera. We just take that out of the equation, and we let people know essentially the following thing. And that is that, guess what? You are responsible for what happens to you. And I'm not here to rescue you, okay? I'm here to be a support system and assist you, and I'm here to be essentially a buffer against absolute disaster, and I will always be that. But what you think is absolute disaster and what is absolute disaster are two different things. And so we have to come to terms with somebody being uncomfortable and anxious and broke and not having a cell phone and upset and embarrassed, that's fine. Okay, the only thing I'm worried about are literally threats to life. Those are the kinds of things, or catastrophic financial issues like driving some car without car insurance. So mm-hmm. there are things that we cover, and there's things we let go. And we try to put them in a position to understand that it's time for them to not be considering that the parent is effectively a blank check that they essentially can always rely on. So that's how we deal with that. That's the general set of ideas.
Interesting. So yeah, when you were saying that you take away the things that the parents don't really want to do, it gave me a little flashback when I was, I think, in junior high or high school. I was never like that extreme, but I was a wild kid. I always got into mischief. And I would get into trouble once in a while. So, you know, I had my door taken off of my room because I think I slammed it once or twice. And,
right.
And one time I was in school and, I was expected to set very high grades, very good grades. And I think I probably could have tried more, to be honest. And I got, I got a grade that wasn't acceptable to my parents. So mm-hmm. I intercepted the report card in the mail. And went
of
to
course.
The copy machine and cut out the bad grade and then glued in the correct grade, not the correct grade, but
the correct grade,
the good grade. What do they call that? A Freudian slip?
Yes, so, that's what it was.
So my dad caught me, and they took away everything in my room except for one pair of underwear, one pair of pants, and one shirt, and that was it. And I had to earn everything back. So one by one. So yeah, it's
beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. You got just what you deserved, and it didn't hurt you at all. Excellent.
Yeah. So right. No, this is good stuff. So how my big question here though is when we say flake, in my mind, I think they're at the low conscientiousness. So they're at the bell curve, maybe the lower part of the bell curve. It sounds like what you're saying is this is a combination between a flaky, could be somebody who just doesn't feel anxiety, that they're not doing the right thing, but also they might just have lack of motivation for a whole number of different factors.
Yes, and in either case, this is the right strategy.
Mm-hmm.
So the probably, and this is what parents, there's great consternation. So let's look in and try to figure out what drives a great deal of parental consternation when the flake starts emerging and they start realizing that, you know, the kid is now 13 years old and we're seeing a lot of flaky behavior and we're not sure what to make of this. And we are essentially, what goes on inside parents' heads is that, oh my God, I'm not sure that they're going to do so well in school. If they don't well in school, they won't go to a good college. They don't go to college, they're not going to get a good job. They don't get a good job, they're not going to have good money. They're not going to have good money. They're not going to be able to mate as effectively. They're not going to be as mate effectively. And that grandchildren are going to have slightly worse genes. Now, the parents don't quite consciously put all those dots together, but it's close. And unconsciously, they're also fearing that there's going to be a flake on their hands at 19 or 20 or 20 or 21 years old. And they're like counting down the clock as to when they can start redirecting their resources to their own personal interests. So there's a weaning conflict that is bubbling under here. That's essentially part of nature where the children are going to want resources to get resources from the parents longer than the parents are going to want to give them to the kid. So at any rate, this is the conflict that's bubbling under here, and there's a misunderstanding, a profound misunderstanding about developmental psychology that is bubbling through this, which is that what's happening at 13 is formative. So one of the obviously the most important mistake in the concept of personality and development in psychology is the notion of what we're going to call the formative years, the notion that somehow things are forming when a kid is, you know, 3 to 13.
Oh, yeah.
These are
so
not
the parents
formative
don't teach
years.
Them the habits.
Yeah,
if they don't teach them the habits.
At all.
Okay.
Sure.
Interesting.
Now, this has nothing to do with anything. What you're seeing is these are the emergent years. You are watching who this kid is emerge out of life. They're not forming anything. And you say, oh no, but I saw it, you know, when he was 7 years old, he was really well organized, and 10 years old, he's organized, so he was forming the habits to be a good CPA when he was 10 years old. No, you are seeing the genes of a highly intelligent, highly conscientious, emotionally stable human at 7 years old, for God's sakes. No surprise the kid went on to be a CPA. So this is a misunderstanding of personality and development. And so parents, because of this misunderstanding, they have considerable anxiety when the 13-year-old is a flake, because they're thinking, oh my God, I've got to shape them in to what will be a really good, hardworking college student if we're going to get a good job, graduate, blah, blah, blah. So they're seeing that their trajectory of the graph of this person's development is not going the direction that they would most hope for high achievement. And so this also, incidentally, will take place in parents that are sweating bullets over a kid that isn't achieving that well, even if the kid's trying reasonably hard, but they're not that smart. And the parents will fret about this because they can see the doom that their children are not going to be able to go to college and be a professional, and they really, 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 really want them to be. And it's like, relax. It's either the kid either has the chops or they don't have the chops. And how hard they work at 12 or 13 years old isn't going to have anything to do with this. It's going to be completely irrelevant. So this is obviously a radical sounding view, but it is the correct view. It's what essentially all of the scientific evidence points to. Now,
and then,
as a result of that, yeah, go ahead.
And then also, what does it have to do also with, you know, society or other parents looking at it and judging the parents, saying,
oh
yeah, you're not as good of a parent because your kid isn't performing at this level.
There's no question.
So now they've got status on the line.
Sure. So you've got a lot of little problems there that are causing a great deal of consternation on the part of parents that are watching some kid that's not living up to their potential and sort of fiddling around. So there's different reasons why a kid might not live up to their potential, but at the end of the day, we understand in principle that all of the motivational systems are understandable and that they're all a derivative of cost-benefit analysis. And so there, it could be that a kid is in the ego trap because the expectations are too high and they're pulling the other direction. So we've talked about that at length in previous podcasts. So as a parent, you certainly do not want to set the bar high and push because you will get the kid going the other direction. You want to set the bar at a moderate level of what it is that the kid is reasonably easily able to achieve in school and call it good. And if the kid goes beneath that, no problem. There's consequences. Then we take the cell phone and the computer away. Not a problem. None at all. Okay? And if the more they wail and are upset about it, relax. This is not somebody that has just been bitten by a jackal on the African savannah. This is just somebody that just got inconvenienced. Okay? And so we have to get comfortable with essentially making them uncomfortable if it's appropriate to do so. Now, as these kids continue on, we're going to find out as they get a little bit older whether or not they are a flake by nature, i.e. low conscientiousness, or whether or not they've got chops in them, but they have to be appropriately motivated. And so the way we do this is just as I said, we set up constraints with very reasonable expectations and limited assistance, et cetera. And then we find out if you have a flake, the flake will couch surf, you know, apply for welfare, God knows what they're going to do, okay? Join a band, who knows? If your kid actually has plenty of responsibility and just was basically a too overly comfortable middle-class animal in a zoo that didn't have to do anything to earn its keep, and now you have forced it out the door and made it face the wild, it will spontaneously get extremely responsible. And the good news is that when they get responsible and they actually get a job and start working, they feel better. Okay, they feel better because they feel the sense of esteem process that comes with knowing that they are a self-feeding, self-responsible life unit, and feels good. And so now they've learned something. Now, believe me, a lot of people, if they didn't have to work, they wouldn't. They would just sit at home, and they can't wait to just sit at home. And there's reasons for that. But if you sit at home indefinitely and you don't contribute and don't do anything that's income producing, it's going to start gnawing at your esteem. It's going to be a problem. So these kids are willing to sit at home for a while because it's legitimate enough in your early 20s or late teens to not be doing much and thinking big thoughts and accomplishing nothing. And people might think that I'm disparaging all young people. I'm not. We're not talking about all young people. We're talking about the 10 or 20% that are lazy enough or irresponsible enough that fall into this pattern. And so, you know, awful lot of young kids are just absolutely full of ambition and energy and desire and are push, push, push. So completely different animals, one animal to the next. But the solution to the dilemma of what do I have here? Do I have an irresponsible flake or do I have a perfectly responsible kid that is under no anxiety and is inherently lazy and thus we push them? Answer is find out. You're not going to do anybody any harm, and you can take a lot of stress off the parents and knowing that you are doing the right thing to put this animal under stress. That's what we want to do, and what we get is what we get, and either whatever happens, it's fine.
Mm-hmm. We're making peace with the worst possible outcome.
Yeah, worst possible outcome is we find out that our kid is a flake and is never going to do anything. It's like, oh, well, you know, good thing we didn't put him in that fancy $25,000 a year school that was supposed to teach them how to be different, because this is what we would have gotten.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's not going to happen for most people, but most of the time, what we really see is young people who are who have had it easy, who have had parents cover costs, cover them, essentially allow them to be irresponsible, and we have some kids that'll push the limit. And it isn't that they won't actually get their act together. It's just that they will. You have to push them. You have to give them some consequences to get their act together. And most of the time, if you do, they'll respond very well.
Okay. And now, so now let's say you know, we've dealt with the kids. How do we deal with flaky people in general? I mean, in business, if I'm dealing with someone, I can sense their low conscientiousness. I'm just not even going to do business with them. It's just going to be, you know, polite, nice, superficial, that's it. But for friends or for, you know, for flaky friends who, you know, people listening to the podcast, they may not be realizing that one or two friends might be flaky here and there. But how do they deal with flaky people in general?
Well, you know, flaky people, what's going to happen is that you're going to be doing a cost-benefit analysis on them sort of unconsciously. And so you're going to be winding up irritated with them and realizing that they're kind of mediocre investments. And and so it's what's good about having the big five in your head and understanding that personality is genetic, and so that we can understand that when we see a pattern of somebody's behavior and we can line it up to other people's behavior, that the reasons why we're seeing what we're seeing are largely likely to be genetic. You know, with certainly there's some there can be situational factors that are involved for various periods of time. But in principle, that's what it is that we're seeing. So if you're an adult and you have adult friends and one of them's flake, then you understand that that's what it is. And so as a result of that, you run a cost-benefit analysis on why that individual's even in your life. And I'm not saying that they shouldn't be in your life. It depends upon how enjoyable they are and how interesting they are at other things. But we certainly know that they are a relatively poor investment. So unlike people that are high conscientiousness, people that are high conscientiousness are actually outstanding investments. They so if you're going to live life long enough to make use of this, the notion is that the and this is what old timers we call conscientiousness is essentially what we call character. And so if we realize that human beings, whether we like it or not, are essentially operating with each other as insurance policies, that's what friendship relationships are. Now, we may not think of it that way, and there's certainly other elements, but at the end of the day, that's an extremely important process that is taking place between any two people who call themselves friends. And so the problem with having friends that are significantly less conscientious than yourself is that you will tend to analyze the relationship from your own personal perspective with respect to what you think is going on with respect to the trade. So this is going to be what we call the egocentric bias. So suppose you're a very high conscientious person. And in your mind's eye, you would say, well, boy, if my friend got into trouble, I would really go in for a lot of effort. You know, I'd spend a year of doing hard labor to dig them out of some Mexican prison. And I would. Yeah, it'd be like, wow, I wouldn't spend 10 years, but boy, for Bill over there, he's a pretty good friend of mine. Yeah, if he was really in trouble and it wasn't fair and, you know, if I needed to dig him out of a Mexican prison, I would do it. Now, the problem is Bill can hear your thoughts and feelings. He knows who you are. He can tell that you're higher conscientiousness. So he might even make sounds and smells and noises and have some actions that make it look like he sort of feels the same way. But if we look at his behavior and we're tracking what his behavioral history is across various domains, we recognize that he's actually significantly lower in conscientious than we are. He's kind of fun, open to experience, you know, showed you what mushrooms were like to smoke them or whatever the hell it was when you were, you know, 19. So the point is he may be an interesting character, but you keep your eye on this and realize that you may be a $1 million insurance policy for him, but he's worth about $3,000 worth of insurance policy to you. So effectively, in that friendship, you are over-insuring him. and you are being taken in a trade that you don't even know is taking place. And so that's why having friends that are significantly lower conscientious than ourselves are, it's not that I'm saying it's terrible and they should never have them, et cetera. You run a cost-benefit analysis on some of them. But when there's a significant discrepancy between your level of conscientiousness and someone else's, then what you do is you use yourself as a baseline to estimate sort of how much insurance you are probably getting back, and you are likely to vastly overestimate the insurance that you would get back in return for the insurance that you're extending in that friendship. And therefore, it is very likely that in the long run, you're going to get taken. Okay? So that's why my attitude is, if someone shows me that they're a flake, then I am taking a step back. And I'm not talking about one transgression, but I might talk about any one transgression that is significant. I had a friend that she had a person in her family die. And a woman that was supposedly a good friend of hers, pretty good friend of hers, was all excited about doing the food for the wake and really was pushy about how she wanted to do the food for the wake, and she wanted to be in charge of it because she was a catering type person and she was really going to take center stage and do this thing. Well, within like 2 days before the wake was going to take place, and anybody that's ever been through a funeral knows this all happens pretty fast. So you're hustling around. There's a thousand details to deal with. And so a couple days before, might have been the night before, I think it was actually the night before, the flake called and said, oh, I just can't do it. I'm just overwrought with emotion and I can't do it. It's like, wow.
Wow.
You've got a whole bunch of people coming to this thing.
It's unbelievable.
You're right in the middle. You've had a family member die. You yourself are grieving. And this person who really wanted all the status to be the big fancy person at the wake that did the food is like bailing out right at the 11th hour.
Wow.
Okay, there you go. And so when I was
counseling
this person, yeah, I said, listen, that's it. You've now discovered that that person is a worthless insurance policy. And folks, a worthless insurance policy is a lot worse than no insurance policy at all. Because you are psychologically investing in people that are flakes, and you are extending insurance to them at the expense of other people that you would be making connections with that you would be extending insurance to. You've only got so many people that you can put in your life's lifeboat. And so it makes sense for the quality of your life to not be too open to experience and not be too agreeable. And sharpen up those eyeballs when it comes to the investment in friendships. So the spotting flaky behavior is a very useful thing in this life, because if they're a little bit flaky when things are small, they're likely to be big flaky when things are big. And so we are way better off investing in people of high conscientiousness. And that's, I think, the big lesson for tonight.
Very interesting. I think we'll end there. Dr.
Yeah.
Lyle, thank you so much. Wonderful, wonderful information. Really appreciate it.
Very good.
Pleasure,
Nate.
Excellent.
You got it.
Excellent. So, you know, next week we're going to read some questions from some listeners. We got some questions about death and dying. We've got some questions about people who actually have no desire to have kids. You know, all kinds of different questions. So I really appreciate all the listeners. Great questions. Keep them coming. And we will see everybody next week. Thanks, Dr. Lyle. Really appreciate it.
Very cool. Talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.